and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It's March 17th, barely, because as this recording has taken forever to get started, it may be March 18th by the time we get through the introductions. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. John Lindemann.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, James.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, John. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Guillaume.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. Do you, how do you feel, James? Are you,
how do I feel?
Do you have a nice tea to keep you awake or something? Do you have,
I'm not dying today if you want to make fun of my troubles.
Yeah, I mean, are you rested, James? I mean, because you can always take a nap if you want.
First off, I'm just concerned.
I'm not making fun, I'm just concerned.
I'm sorry. You're right. I should have not fallen asleep because I was feeling like I was gonna die. You're right.
You're right.
You could be a total asshole about it. Thank you. Greg,
I'm not sure I should wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day? I'm the only one with Irish.
I'm concerned.
I have Irish heritage. I'm just
concerned. Is it okay to wish an Englishman happy St. Patrick's Day?
Well, I have Irish heritage, so it's fine. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Well, then happy St. Patrick's Day, Greg.
Bum, 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 bum.
Fuck you all. That'll do it for our FM this week, man. Fuck these guys. We'll be back next week when I've got a whole new cast of not assholes.
So is he Mr. Dream now?
It's episode 468.
Are we like inside a Punch-Out?
Fuck you guys.
Enter Sandman, maybe.
Where's Mariano Rivera when you need him? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
For those of you listening at home, after an hour of toiling to get this show going, these guys don't spend that hour taking all their shots. Then they come after me now.
It has to be on the record.
Yeah,
but there's a line, and I'm just gonna end it with something along the lines of, "You gentlemen best not miss." So. This is the start of the episode and probably the end of the series if this keeps going. But we decided that we've, for many reasons, not just limited to my debilitating illness last week, you jackasses, that we have not been able to get to email for a while. We had the retroactive a couple weeks ago. Last week we had the short episode, and we did email the week before, but we didn't get through as many as we wanted because of, guess what? Skype problems. So... we're back again. Email is apparently cursed. But we've got a lot of email this week, and we decided to, as Guillaume has referred to it, oops, all emails. And that's what we're going to do. We've, in fact, got a lot of emails picked out. And if you haven't heard your email, we have a huge backlog. That doesn't mean I don't want you to send more, though. Bury me in your emails. It's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's an email address if you're unfamiliar with the concept. And we... in fact, I think the most recent email in the batch I pulled only goes to the middle of February. And there are emails older than that that I left out because they thematically clash with other emails, or they're too similar, or just trying to get variety in there. So, like I said, we've got a lot of emails, and we want more. I always want more. I'm a glutton for your emails, so send them. You can send us your emails. Now, the challenge is, of course, I don't have an order picked out for emails. Because apparently these guys can just let all of our in secrets of off-recording out. I'm just going to say, I didn't pick out an order. We're just going to do it by ear. So, John.
All right, Chris writes, "Hello, RFN. I just wanted to start off by saying how much I enjoy the show. Even with the adjustments made over the past few months, I still find myself eagerly
awaiting..."
And
some more to come, apparently.
"...my long 4-hour drives on Sunday night since I'll have a new podcast to listen to. All right, now on to my question. With the recent closing of game trailers, I find myself both confused and flustered about why the site went down and what this means for the future of quote-unquote games journalism. There's a lot of speculation about why exactly the site went downhill. Some people blame the buyout of game trailers from Viacom. Others blame game trailers for the lack of high content that used to be frequent on their site, and there is also the common belief that the homogenization of video consumption that is YouTube killed the site due to YouTube not only stealing ad revenue from the website, but also the over-saturation of personalities over academic analysis. My question to you guys is this. Why do you feel game trailers failed, and what does this mean about the state of quote-unquote games journalism? What does this mean for sites like NWR, Nintendo World Report, that are mostly run by writers who don't get paid to write and create content? Lastly, do you feel there is a need for academic analysis within games journalism, and if so, why? Thanks for reading this, and keep up the good work.
I never really watched game trailers, but...
You're the problem, Guillaume.
Yeah, I guess. But first, I was not aware that they had all these academics, unloading their game theories or whatever it is on game trailers. That seems like... That seems surprising.
To some extent, I wouldn't go in there and say, oh god, this is the dissertation zone for video games.
Right.
Like they had their mix of dumb internet stuff too. Like, yeah. And I say that, like, John and I, you know John more formally than I do, know Daniel Bloodworth. He used to write for Nintendo World Report. Mm-hmm. Like, so we have some connection to the site, but ultimately, like, they did have that kind of stuff there, but I mean, keep in mind that the site is called Game Trailers. Like, that's what they used to be. And at some point, with the homogenization of video availability, they had to branch out. And that was the kind of stuff that they picked up. I mean, it was a site purely focused as video content.
Right.
Which, when it came out, was a very novel thing. Like, because if you wanted to see game trailers, like...
There was not one spot where you could go to watch game trailers, right?
Like,
You could watch, like, shitty QuickTime videos.
Right.
But, yeah, YouTube wasn't a thing... My most intimate memory of using game trailers, at least early on, was like watching trailers of stuff like Baten Kaitos. Because that was the only way you could watch that trailer. Because IGN would have their really horseshit proprietary video player, which is just this like wrapped reel player. And it would just look like complete garbage, and it would buffer, and it would just be awful. And then you had this site that was like, here's basically an MP4 of the video, and Just let it buffer. Let it load for a while. And then you can hit play. Like, they had to diversify. So that's where you started to see things like analysis. You started to see what were essentially video podcasts come into being. You saw a lot of the things that you expect now from other video game sites. Personality-driven content. You know, content where you're tuning in to see the person, not the game.
Yep. In terms of, you know, what this means for our website is... I mean, I think the reason why our website stays around is because we don't pay people to write for it. That's the problem.
Our costs are minuscule.
Yes, minuscule compared to some of these other sites that have to actually pay people to write for them, and or even pay freelancers or whatever.
Technicians, developers.
Yeah, exactly.
People
who develop
the
website.
Develop code for the site.
Yeah, yeah.
Support technicians.
Yep. All that costs
attorneys.
Money. And it's very
secretaries.
Yeah, and I mean it's very
cleaning
hard.
Cleaning staff. Like there's
it's yeah, there's, I mean it's very hard to make money off of video game content, especially when there stuff like YouTube is out there where you have people creating content for free on their own, and it's very hard to compete against the might of the entirety of the internet YouTubing scene.
I did a little bit of research on this particular topic. One of the factors that a lot of sites have their own proprietary video players. And of course, the reason is that when you post videos on YouTube, YouTube gets a cut, or Google gets a cut, effectively, or Alphabet, whatever term you want to use for them at the moment. Whereas if you host the video, obviously, you don't have to pay any of that. And when video hosting was exorbitantly expensive and bandwidth was exorbitantly expensive, that was a problem. And you'd say, well yeah, Google can take, Google can have their blood. I don't care. But with the proliferation of things like, just completely valueless rack storage, just completely unlimited, that's not the problem anymore. But getting someone to use your video player on your site, which probably isn't as compatible with the broad spectrum of browsers as YouTube is, probably isn't as convenient to use, and they're probably not already there, is hard. Because on YouTube, they're probably already there, and YouTube does a very good job of feeding you a constant stream of shit to watch. Mm-hmm. That's why when they released that update about a year ago that by default turns on Play Next Video. Mm-hmm. Like that's why they have this curated stream based on what you've watched in the past I think you'll be interested in. Their job, YouTube's job, singularly, is to keep you on YouTube forever. So they can hit you with an ad every 20 minutes or whatever.
Yep. And Game Trailers, they had their own video player, correct? Didn't they?
They did. Yeah, Game Trailers hosted their own videos because they wanted to get your ad revenue from you seeing their ads on their page and not having to give YouTube their, you know, their pound of flesh.
Exactly.
I don't remember if they co-listed on YouTube, but you see a lot of like YouTube celebrities now have done the same thing. They've launched their own site with their videos on it, and essentially they're willing to split their YouTube demographic, even if they know the majority will stay on YouTube because they get so much more return for people who watch it on their site. Mm-hmm. The problem with an outlet like Game Trailers is they have an incredibly high overhead. And even in the event that they're making money, they may not be making enough money for their corporate overlords.
That's exactly it too.
So even if they're a profitable enterprise, even if it's just like on the margins profit, that may not be enough to deal with the logistical overhead of running an additional outlet. Game Trailers, I mean, not having any real insight into the internal operations, but based on what they produced, is a sophisticated outlet. Like, there was a lot going on there, and, mm-hmm. and the management, making sure they have the right equipment, making sure they have the right facilities, making sure things like the garbage gets taken out by the cleaning staff, like making sure the power stays on in their studio, making sure that when they book people, like, they're available and somebody follows up to make sure it's all taken care of.
Yeah.
Like, all of that stuff is work that maybe not doesn't hit the bottom line, but somebody has to manage it, and maybe the decision is just, we can't be bothered.
Yeah, and I mean, Viacom really doesn't care. I mean, Viacom is like, does that site make money? Yeah, yes or no. If it does make money, how much money does it make?
Does it make enough money?
Yeah, does it make enough money compared to these other properties?
It's an opportunity cost issue. If they feel like they could be putting that kind of resources to better use, more greater returns, then, as you said, it doesn't actually have to be hemorrhaging money to be something they don't want to deal with anymore.
I mean, the challenge with Game Trailers is you have, I mean, we talked about YouTube, but there's so much content out there in the video game space now. It's actually arguably overcrowded.
Yeah.
And I think as you see outlets start to fall away, I think that's ultimately going to be borne out.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, you have outlets like Giant Bomb who produce really high quality content, and they produce a lot of it. They ultimately have three production staffs now.
Yeah.
They've got the one in New York, and they've got effectively enough to constitute two in LA.
Yeah, but I mean, but the thing is, they've also managed to stick around because of the people that work for the site. I mean, there are people that are
well,
fans
that's what I'm saying.
Specifically.
Like, they've got,
like they're yeah. I mean, they're exactly like, you know, everybody on YouTube, like the you know, personality driven kind of content.
They are the personality driven site that's able to be successful off the YouTube stream. Although they put a lot of their content on YouTube as well.
Yep.
But ultimately, like, I'm just mentioning more that they're able to produce a shit ton of content.
Yeah.
And they're just one player in the field that's able to pump stuff in.
Yeah.
I really only regularly consume one YouTuber who could be constituted as doing Let's Play stuff, and not really. They added on more of their friends just because they wanted to make sure they were putting enough content out there. The thing is, with YouTube stuff, really, revenue doesn't come from having one popular video. It comes from having a lot of fucking videos.
And a lot of subscribers.
It comes from being active and having a lot of content. And it's the same thing with streaming. If you're on Twitch, it's not just about having one stream where you fucking blow it out. It's about being constantly active.
Yeah.
And getting people watching you. And that's the thing. Especially if you have Twitch, where there's a sense of like immediacy. Like, this is, I'm going to watch this guy right now for 2 hours because he's live. I can interact with him. I'm not damning the content Game Trailers are producing, nor am I arguing there's not a market for them. What I'm arguing is that all the players in the market have this impetus to put shit out constantly and to be constantly active and to be just producing content at such a high rate that there's just a flood. And I'll bring it home to NWR briefly. NWR has their NWR TV YouTube page, and we put a lot of content out there. And its success is almost entirely predicated on the volume with which we are putting content onto that page.
Mm-hmm.
And if we continue to put content out there at a high rate, video views in general go up. And if we put content on slow down, video views drop off.
Yep.
Individually.
It's been like that on the website too, in general.
Yeah, in general. If the website is active, individual stories get more eyes. And if the website is slow, individual stories get less eyes. Now, collectively, of course, you get more eyes because there's more things to see.
Yep.
But stories themselves get more eyes individually because people come there, they see updates, so they keep coming there and they keep seeing updates. Even on the podcast feed, where most of our listeners just subscribe to it and just download it, and it just shows up And I mean, I know this. I have PodTrack. It tells me that most of them are just getting a download automatically. When we post extra things, like 2 weeks ago, and we just carpet bombed the feed, the other episodes, the episodes that got buried, got more listens. So there is this kind of like rotating door of like, if you put stuff out there, old stuff gets viewed too.
Yeah. And I mean, really with RFN too, I mean, way back in the day, our audience didn't start to go up until we actually started putting stuff out weekly, because we used to not do that.
Yeah.
Way, way back. We'd just put it out maybe like one episode every 3 weeks, or when we had a chance, or maybe a couple of episodes back to back really close.
Or I'd get behind on editing and we'd drop 3 episodes in 3 days.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's a really good sense of, you know,
regularity.
If you keep feeding people stuff, they will keep coming back to eat it.
So the question is, why didn't game trailers build the audience that was successful enough? And the answer is, I can't tell you. Maybe the game trailers guys could tell us.
Yeah,
but maybe not.
And that's the thing. I mean, I don't know really what was going on with that site money wise, but maybe they were making enough to keep the lights on, but that was not good enough, obviously, for Viacom.
Right. Now, I will say, to not be negative, some of the players that have left the space, you know, it's always unfortunate when somebody loses their job. Like, it's usually unfortunate when somebody loses their job. But it's not like that smart content isn't getting produced. What I think we found is that you have more niche content providers who are producing very well-focused content on very specific topics. And we didn't have that before. I tweeted out a video the other day from YouTuber, I think goes by the name Super Bunny Hop or something like that. Not a games journalist, but was reporting on SNK reported that they're gonna leave the pachinko space, the pachi slot space, which sounds, for Japanese game development, bearing in mind they've got a Chinese overlord now, sounds completely insane. Because you think about all the people who have gone into that space, they're saying we're getting out. And a lot of sites wrote articles saying SNK is leaving the pachi slot space. Isn't that great? Maybe we'll get a Metal Slug. And of course they announced the King of Fighters coming, like a real console King of Fighters. But this one specific YouTuber went and tried to figure out why are they leaving that space, and read a bunch of things on like industry sites that cover gambling machines. Like, understanding they very loosely put in a statement that they're concerned about potential Japanese regulation on pachi slot stuff. The infamous quote random parts with the interactive video monitors, you know, the part where it screams that you flip the lever. Like, how he went and researched what specific kinds of laws the Japanese government is looking at putting in place and why that would concern a company like that. And, you know, found well-researched documents from both original reporting in the Japanese media and in English language reports on the Japanese language media and in industry write-ups. And, like, that is one of the most well-researched videos I've ever seen about a very specific topic that, from someone who doesn't speak Japanese and isn't in Japan, would have been very, very difficult to do. And that kind of content creation is available now explicitly because you don't have to be tied to one of these outlets. So while it's very easy to look at the situation and just say, this is the death of games media, that's a little bit reductionist. There is a certain degree, and I'm going to sound crazy, like, this is pie in the sky stuff. There is a certain amount of the democratization of the ability to research things you care about. And ultimately, having done games media for a long time, like, all of us have been in this game for a while. John's been in this game forever.
Forever.
You know, if you're actively involved and not just doing a podcast every week and pretending like you're a big shot in the games media, like, you're having to report on a lot of shit you don't care about. You're having to write articles about the fact that that the Wii U Street View is going down. Like, you don't give a shit about that. But if you really care about it, if you're a content creator who's super passionate about Street View on non-computers, you might go do the digging and find out why that business arrangement shutting down. You know, what was it? Why wasn't it successful? You know, how much did it get used? You might go do the digging there to produce what is actually a particularly interesting piece of content. But nobody at a game site is going to do that, because it's too much work for something that they're not passionate about and it probably isn't going to move the numbers. And if you don't have a corporate overlord over you, you can do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and also at the same time, I mean, if they do produce mainstream content, that content is probably being offered elsewhere. So you can see where sites like Game Trailers get pinched because they get it from both ends. They get it from, you know, if they have boutique content, it doesn't get any eyes on it. And it doesn't
make... Not enough,
exactly. Not enough to make a considerable amount of money, right? And if they go with the mainstream content, well, they can't win there either because somebody can just go to YouTube. And they don't care. I mean, they go to YouTube and there's an infinite amount of that kind of content out there if they want the real mainstream, you know, some idiot playing a horror game and having a funny reaction to it. I mean, there's 1,000 videos like that on YouTube at any given time.
The democratization of content is bad in certain degrees if you are in the traditional outlet. But if you have interests or like niche interests or things you really want to see covered, this is really just a normal maturation of the field. But this sort of like the ability for content producers to make very specialized sub-niche, you know, examinations doesn't necessarily erode the capacity for a more generalized content providers. I think what we're seeing is that media in general, not just the games media, is getting, as John says, is getting pinched by new formats and new providers and new sources of this kind of content. And it'll level out. Eventually, you'll see players that are on more stable ground able to stay there. And you'll see ones who are on less stable ground try to get there. You'll see Polygon do Let's Plays for some reason. And some of these will fail. Some of this flailing to try to follow the almighty dollar will fail, and sites will go down for it. Mm-hmm. Some sites will decide they're going to stick to their guns, and it will either be successful or unsuccessful for them.
Well, I mean, another reason why we're still around is because we are a more niche, we're Nintendo-focused, so
yeah,
we are more niche.
We're in a specific market.
Yep. I mean, I guarantee if we were like an Xbox or if we were an Xbox site, we'd probably be gone. If we were a Sony site, we'd probably be gone.
And Nintendo is a little bit more easy to have a specific site because the fan base is... A, the fan base feels underserved by the general media sites.
Yep.
And to a certain extent, that's not untrue.
Yep.
But some of it's also psychological. There is a certain amount of bunker mentality. Mm-hmm. But I say that with love, audience. But in general, we're able to survive. I mean, to be honest, we're able to survive because our costs are relatively small. I would say we're lucky, but that does come with its own challenges that we have accepted by being in this space. Guillaume.
Yes?
Can you do me a favor and read Alex's email?
Sure. Alex writes, "Hey guys, GameSpot reviewed each part of Fire Emblem Fates separately. While lots of publications are doing this, Nintendo World Report decided to review it as one game, which I agree with. However, GameSpot gave Fire Emblem Conquest a lower score than the others." The other versions, I guess?
Yeah.
Because the reviewer found it too hard. Part of his criticism is that the game lacks gameplay the other two versions have, i.e. the extra grinding time, or extra grinding missions, I guess. Nintendo may have released two versions of the game, with the third version on the way. Yeah, this is an old email. But in my opinion, these equal one full game. The two versions have even been marketed as having different difficulty levels. My question is this, do you think this is fair? Should a reviewer take into account the difficulty in their score? Is this review even credible? The core point of Fire Emblem games is resource management, and the reviewer lets a bunch of his characters die and then complained when the end game was too hard. Thanks a bunch. Congratulations on the weight loss, James. I am currently working towards a similar weight loss."
Thanks! I actually meant to cut that part out of the email, so that's fine. But thank you. Alex, good luck. It's
well,
it is the biggest...
I can still cut it.
So. No. I do want to wish Alex... I was going to actually just had a note to myself. Hey, when we get to the end of the email, wish Alex luck on it.
Okay.
So yeah, Alex, thank you. Good luck. It was a lot of work, but oh my God, was it worth it? Mm. Except for having to buy new clothes every 3 to 6 months. That part sucked. But that's hopefully over. But
yes,
Fates. Am I the only person who's played any of Fates?
Still, yes.
All right.
But to me, I mean, I seem to I kind of see a contradiction in the email, just because, you know...
Lay it on me.
Alex says that he agrees with reviewing the game as one game, but then he points out these differences that the two versions have, you know? So they've both been marketed as having different difficulty levels. And, you know, like, the Conquest version is missing extra missions, or kind of, like, missions to grind in, so...
Yeah, well, it has a different kind of ethos, really, you know, that reflects the fact. So, you know, I mean, it is kind of a substantively different experience rather than just, like, a few Pokemon are different, like, in a red-blue scenario or whatever.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, I think you can make the argument to review them separately, but, I mean, it's up to... I just think it's up to individual sites... to choose what works for them, as long as it's adequately explained and accounted for in the text of the review. I don't really have a problem with it, because I mean, no, as much as we might like to believe that if you write a review, it's the definitive verdict and no other review need ever be read, you know, that is not reality. There will always be plenty of other reviews, and certainly when I'm, you know, reading reviews about games, you know, I will read a range, you know, and so it's fine if one outlet reviews it as one, you know, sort of entity, and another outlet reviews them separately. One outlet might sort of have a completely different approach in terms of, you know, letting the characters die or that whole thing. You know, just if you read from a range, it's not going to be that big of a problem, you know. I mean, I mean, if he feels like he wanted, or he or she that wrote the review in question felt like they wanted to, you know, take it lower the score for the difficulty, well, that's their decision. I mean, you could agree or disagree with it, but I mean, if that's clear to you from the text, you can kind of just make that adjustment on your end. Right. You know, I'd say, like, yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't dock it for that, so that informs my purchasing decision. Like, it's still sort of done you a service, even if you don't fully agree with it. And like I said, there's a lot of reviews to draw on out there. So it's not, I mean, I understand the point that's being made, but I don't think, you know, it's anything I personally would get terribly caught up in, because I just feel like it's having a range of different approaches to reviews and all that kind of thing is ultimately helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I always used to look at, you know, like, what the appeal of a game to the average person, because obviously, if you're a fanboy of the series, you're going to love it regardless whether it's easy, hard, whatever.
Well, actually...
Or you might be critical of different things.
Yeah, you might, yeah, yes. Or you might be very demanding, I mean,
exactly.
In some cases.
Right. So speaking specifically of Fates, I might actually give Birthright... I mean, I like Birthright distinctly less than Awakening. I think it does a lot of the things that Awakening did and actually delivers on them better. But I think ultimately how the levels are structured and how the world, like, yeah, it's marketed as being the easier game. I knew that going in.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I can't look at the game and go, like, guys, easy, not brain dead.
Would you classify them, the three, as vastly different experiences, though? That's a real question to me.
Yeah, but they're probably as vastly different as one Fire Emblem is to the next, no? I mean, they've got different story, they've got different, different level design, different missions.
No, but they do have the same world, which a lot of Fire Emblems don't. So it is a bit of a grey area, but like I said, that's the thing. I mean, I think it's legitimate that different outlets handle that differently. I don't think there is a correct way to do it.
I think if a reviewer plays all three and says all of these three feel the same, then that's fine. If a reviewer just plays one and reviews that one experience, I think that's also okay, because I wouldn't want the reviewer... What I wouldn't want is a reviewer to play one and then collectively review all three.
I agree with that.
Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's
well,
the problem.
It's just dishonest.
Not necessarily, like, explicitly dishonest, but if they just played Birthright, for example, and wrote up a review with the heading Fire Emblem Fates, no caveat, no colon, secondary title... And you said, this is our review of Fire Emblem Fates. I don't think it's dishonest.
Wait, it's negligent, though. It's negligent.
Right, yes, it is definitely negligent.
So what I've seen is that I think that perhaps Nintendo did not give review copies far in advance. Like, Atlus has long games, and what they've decided to do is give review copies, like, a month in advance. You've got plenty of time to dig in as a... Or more, yeah. And you've got plenty of time as a reviewer to dig in and to explore and to review the full experience and then write about it. It doesn't mean that every reviewer will, I guess. You know, you can't, you know, hover over their shoulder and make sure that they finish the game, but they're given plenty of time. Here, what I've seen, I've seen most outlets who had reviews for the games day one had different reviewers for each version. So what we're missing here is kind of like, yeah, this point of view of someone who's played both versions and who can compare them directly from, you know, for based on their personal experience with each title. Right now, I'm seeing some reviews come out, like the people who did not get review copies early or who could not, you know, did not have the time to write reviews for day one. I'm seeing some reviews by you know, the same reviewer for both versions. So you might want to look to those if you still haven't purchased the game and you really want to see, well, okay, which one is best, you know?
But, right, and yeah, best is going to be relative because these games are different.
Yeah, sure.
No, so again,
sure,
it's best if it's just they can give you a good, you know, well-communicated account so that even if their sort of preferences or, you know, their choices wouldn't be the same as yours, there's enough information there for you to apply the information to your own internal kind of decision making and preferences. That's all I ask of reviews.
Right.
Yeah, can just like compare, you know, all these different opinions and see what you get out of them. Like you can compare several reviewers' opinions and kind of
interpolate,
get a big picture, right? Like I didn't read the GameSpot reviews, but I read the US Gamers, and so you had Mike Williams reviewing Birthright and Cat Bailey reviewing Conquest, and both of them gave the games the same score. Mike Williams appreciated like the kind of relationship stuff in Birthright. Cat Bailey really appreciated the level design in Conquest, and because I had heard James talk about the poor level design in Birthright, I had like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I wonder what Kat is going to think when she gets around to playing Birthright. And then, yeah, like she talked about it on her podcast and she was less than impressed. So, yeah, like these two games are different. They've got a different design philosophy.
Yeah, paradigm, whatever you want to call it. Yeah,
I think as long as the reviewer is deciding if they feel like they need to write two reviews, it's okay. If they're being dictated from on high, then they need to they should break it up and explain inside each. But if a reviewer played both versions, and I say both because the two retail SKUs, and felt like one review will cover it, I mean that's their call. Hmm. Like I'm not gonna prejudge, having not played Conquest, anybody's decision on how to review it. I think if you went into Conquest and you're like, this game's really hard, why are my characters dying? Then I think what you can not necessarily say the review is invalid, but I think you can very quickly discount that person is probably not the person you should go to for your Fire
right.
Emblem review.
But then again, the GameSpot...
You personally should go to. Yeah. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
But also, like, if you read the GameSpot review, like, that's not how exactly it plays out. Like, the reviewer has played, you know, Fire Emblem games before, and other Fire Emblem games, most of them have some sort of Colosseum or something, a place to grind if you're having difficulty. And I think it's a fair point to make that Conquest lacks that, or doesn't
sure.
have
and,
that many.
And, even though it's and, even though grind. It's in the marketing, and I'm gonna bring up another recent air quotes controversy. Even though it's in the marketing, it's not necessarily fair to assume that people who listen to the show are good representation of what. Actually, it's not in the marketing. It's in the press releases and Nintendo talking about it. It's not fair to assume people who listen to the show are representative of Fire Emblem's audience. We represent a more extreme subset of that audience. And, you know, it's very easy for people to not realize Conquest doesn't have grinding, even though Nintendo said it. The example I would point to is back to like Street Fighter V, where there was this weird backlash against people who were like, man, where's all the fucking single player content? And there was this response like, well, you should have known it's not in there.
Actually, I shouldn't have.
People need to talk about it, and that way I know it's not in there, and I can make an informed purchasing decision. And ultimately, remember, reviews are to help people make Reviews are supposed to be there to help people make informed purchasing decisions. So if you didn't, if you already knew that there was no, you know, grindy grind time, great. You know, if that doesn't bother you, okay. I get that. I get that that's not a problem for you. And, you know, I never made use of the Colosseums in general. But if you didn't know that and you were trying to figure out which version is right for you, that might be a big red flag. And for this reviewer, apparently it was. I'm not going to say it delegitimizes the review, but it may indicate that this reviewer isn't, this reviewer is not coming from a place that it makes sense for you to give much credence to the review for you personally. Hmm. Greg.
Yes. You'd like me to read Leo, would you?
Yes.
Okay, so Leo writes, so I tried to get lucky. I stopped at Walmart on my way to work early Friday morning, and then I took a little time off work Friday morning and showed up at Best Buy a little before they opened. In both cases, I was hoping to snag a special edition of Fire Emblem Fates that someone had pre-ordered and then cancelled. I walked away empty-handed in both cases. On Saturday, I tried to buy Birthright from Best Buy. They sold out, even online, so I ended up downloading it. My question, is it possible, as evidenced by the huge shortage of the special edition and the minor shortage of Birthright, that Nintendo underestimated how popular this game was going to be?
Welcome back to Awakening.
Yeah, probably to a certain degree.
I mean, it sold stupid numbers.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sold way faster than Awakening did.
And Awakening sold way faster than they planned. Yeah, and I couldn't get a physical copy of Awakening for weeks, and I ended up with a digital copy.
At the same time, they're probably like, hey, you know, we're putting out three versions of this game, so...
Well, they put out two.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Well,
but the special edition, you know, contains the third story. It contains all of them on one card, so you could choose and all. But yeah, that was sold out in the States very early. I mean, I think there's a couple of things here. I mean, you know, like, it sold very well. It would have been third on the MPDs for that month if you had collected up all the physical copies that were sold. Is that right?
And it had not been out very long.
Exactly. So, you know, it got off to a really sort of rip-roaring start. I think if there's one area where Nintendo might have underestimated how well it was going to sell, beyond the general sort of thing, I think they might have underestimated how many people actually bought the sort of physical copies or wanted to buy them physical copies, because as we mentioned before, they've sort of provided a fairly powerful kind of incentive to go digital, at least for the sort of other path that you might play second, because you're going to get that for half the price as a sort of expansion, a digital expansion to the version you've got, than you would if you bought both games. But it wouldn't, because there are people who feel very strongly about having physical copies of games or collectors and stuff like that, and the fact that the special edition, which is a physical cartridge that collects everything, was in such limited quantities that, you know, as Leo account, you know, that people just couldn't get them. I think there's probably people that ended up buying physical copies of both, and they probably didn't expect that. I think that if I was going to pinpoint one subset of the sales where they may well have underestimated it, it would be that.
So the game came out, it was mid to late February, and it sold 400,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot of copies of the game to sell, and it did quite well that first. I think the first weekend was like 300,000 or something asinine like that. Like, it sold really, really well and just destroyed Awakening, like, utterly. And Awakening was the game that refocused the entire series, and like this is. Tripling the first month of Awakening. Yeah. This was insane. And to Greg's point, the special edition sold out instantly, effectively, online. And there just were none available. And the special edition really didn't save you money. It was all in the cartridge already. You got the third arc early. You got some fancy stuff. But yeah, I mean, this happened with Awakening. It's happening again with the digital copies being, or physical copies being hard to find. I don't know that they underestimated, though. I think Nintendo isn't exactly hurt if you have to buy the game digitally. I think they would be quite content with that, to be honest. I'm not implying they're attempting to create forced scarcity, but I am saying that with Awakening, a lot of people bought that game digitally who probably would have preferred to buy it physically because they had to, and Nintendo probably isn't all that butthurt about it. And if that happened again, well, that's a shame. I think ultimately their concern would be like, okay, did we catch lightning in a bottle, or did Awakening just like, was it just a crazy fluke? And do we not want to flood the market with a lot of SKUs of
games? No, I mean, I expressed this in a previous episode. You know, I was kind of interested to see how they were going to handle that. I thought it was the kind of thing, you know, that could go over okay in Japan. But I wasn't sure, you know, whether they'd do it the same way in the West. And if they did, whether it would work. But, you know, it seems to, at least at this juncture, have done very well for them. I suppose there could be some sort of lagged effect if some people end up being kind of a bit rubbed the wrong way by how they doled out the content, that it could hurt the sales of the next game, and you wouldn't see that yet. But I'm not, I wouldn't think that's all that probable, you know. But so yeah, I mean, they've must be very pleased with how they, what seemed like a very sort of, and it is, just with the whole review conversation we just had, this very sort of convoluted plan has still resulted in such a great debut.
Yeah, so for reference, this was the 10th best-selling game in Japan last year. Like, it is now hurtling towards, I'd imagine it's crossed the million sales mark at this point, which for this series is just stupid and ridiculous. But, you know, with developing effectively three SKUs, you get some cross-buy, you get some other stuff, you get DLC sales like this. It's an interesting experiment for Nintendo, and I'm, like I said, I doubt they're terribly upset if people had to buy it digitally. You know, oh no, we get to pocket all the money this time. But, you know, they probably didn't underestimate. They were probably just conservative just to be safe, because retailers would not be pleased if they had 20 copies of two versions of Fire Emblem sitting on their shelves.
Yeah, and also, so we assume somewhat natural conservatism, because this is a bit different. You know, this kind of release plan is a bit odd, because it's not just a Pokemon type of situation with the two versions. You know,
Red's not here. Well, I guess I'll get Blue.
Yeah, there's more to it than that. So I'm sure they must have been. Yeah, I think they would have played it a bit safe on that basis.
So I'm actually going to go out of order on emails, because we have an email that actually ties into this nicely, and I didn't think about it at the time. But Twan from the Netherlands writes, "Dear RFN crew, for some time now, I have been thinking about if I should buy my next Wii U /3DS games, for example, Fire Emblem Awakening, retail or digitally. Digital might be easier, but retail is often cheaper. My question is about the NX. Do you guys think I'm better off buying games at retail or digital when I want to play them on NX later on? So what are your thoughts of chances of backwards compatibility for these two kinds of purchases for the NX? And of course, I love your show. You guys are great. You're my favorite podcast, etc., etc. No, seriously, you are. Thank you so much for doing this. House chores are so much more fun with you guys in the background." I feel like now we should just start talking about cleaning for the rest of the
season. You missed the spot.
Yep. Dust the curtains. Don't forget.
Mop harder. Anyway, so I know that we have a bit of a diversity of opinion here on just what your preference is. Like, I'm a retail first kind of person.
But I think that this is a more specific question than just whether you prefer physical or digital. The situation is kind of similar to the PlayStation, the portable, and the Vita. And right. I kind of was lucky in that I bought a PlayStation Go, PSP Go.
There's a phrase nobody ever said.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, so as a result, all of my purchases were digital. And so if I were to get a Vita, I would have all these games already. But the thing is, you never know, right? Like, Sony in Japan had this kind of program where you could, if you had bought the UMDs of certain games, you could get a rebate, I think, on the digital.
Yeah, there was some weird stuff.
Right, but Sony in America never did that. Once we get the word from Nintendo what happens with our digital game collections, we can't even trust them until it's from the mouth of, like,
Can go back and look at the Wii to Wii U and the DSi to 3DS, But there's no clean comparison here because we have no idea what NX is.
Yeah, the disclaimer. Yeah. You've always got to put it there.
Yeah. But in this case, it means even more than usual. Like, we have no idea what NX is. Well, and like,
what kind of the media format would it use? Is it even going to use one for sure? Like,
can it play 3DS games? I don't know. Can it play Wii U games? Who knows?
There's a lot of variables there. But I mean, I think that one of the biggest things that we still don't know that much about, even though it's closer at hand, is the whole My Nintendo account stuff. You know, how much, like, once you get to NX, you know, he talks about the fact that obviously a lot of the time retail's going to be the cheaper way to go. Which is, you know, generally true. And of course, you have the sort of fungibility of a physical good. You can trade it in if you've had enough of it, you know, so you've got like a safety net there, if you're kind of taking a chance on a game. But, you know, with these sort of rewards now, you know, that you're getting, in the new club, we don't know how sort of generous they're going to be exactly once we get to NX and all that kind of stuff. Like, if how much of a kind of power user you are with Nintendo, you know, so it's, it may be, you know, buying games digitally will seem, because don't forget, the digital deluxe program's been gone for like a year now, whatever, more than a year. You know, with Wii U, but they did have that, and that's kind of coming back with My Nintendo and all that, so that could close the gap a little bit in terms of, you know, how attractive it is to buy the digital game. So again, there's just so many variables, it's really difficult to pin it down. I mean, I tend to make more practical decisions in terms of, is this a game that really kind of has a lot of kind of value added to it by having it always present on the system? Or is it something that more I'm just going to come to for dedicated play sessions? The kinds of experiences that are going to be on NX, we must assume there'll be all sorts, but, you know, like, we don't know what the actual lineup's going to be or anything.
Yeah.
But you touch on something, like the whole, like, having it always present on your system, is that
does it add a lot of value? Yeah, I mean,
so I've noticed, you know, I've started buying a lot of physical games because I get them for so much cheaper than the eShop versions.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
Situation in Canada, and I have noticed that perhaps, well, I can't know for sure, but perhaps I've stopped playing Mario Maker and Splatoon earlier than I would have if the games were always on my system.
I get that.
Yeah. And especially for me, with Wii U specifically, the off-TV element is a big thing. You know, like, if something you can play extensively off-TV, then it's nice to be able to have booted up digitally, you know, maybe from another room or whatever. If on the other hand it's not, and you've got to be in front of the TV, well, then what's the hassle of putting the disc in? Not so much, you know. So,
yeah.
But then, you know, as that applies to NX, you know, play the disclaimer again.
Like, you don't know anything.
Yeah.
I would not make purchase decisions based on what I think the NX will have, or even once we know. I don't think it's a good... I think you should really buy your Wii U games for now, to play on a Wii U. And I think that whenever a new generation of systems comes out, you should be prepared. If there's games that you want to keep playing, you should be prepared to keep those systems hooked up to your TV.
Sure.
Yeah. It doesn't really make sense to try to guess what Nintendo has in store for backwards compatibility. And the thing is also, you know, it always depends. If the NX launches with a really strong lineup, you might not look back to your Wii U games. If the NX launches with like some new updated version of Mario Maker, you might not be, you know, you might not have a reason to go back to Mario Maker and Wii U.
Yeah, you just get the upgrade. But Smash Brothers, we talked about that and all that. Yeah,
right.
I mean, that's true, exactly. I just think there's too many variables to make informed decision in this way.
I mentioned the PlayStation Vita. Like, you might not even want an NX. Like, what if it sucks? You know, like, like, the thing is, like, with the PSP Go, I could port forward my library, but I don't want to because the prices for Vita cards are too high. And, like, the same kind of, you know, there's a million reasons why you might not want an NX, and hopefully they won't happen, but just think Wii U for now, I would say.
Well, and to Greg's point, unless you find that the digital the digital situation, you know, with My Nintendo or Nintendo account or whatever fucking term they're using for it right now, works out for you. And or maybe, you know, you catch things when they're on sale. The eShop does sales weekly now. Now, normally it's some god-awful thing from a developer you've never heard of that is using assets from the Unity store. But occasionally, it's something cool. You know, and perhaps one day Nintendo will discount their own games on the digital store.
No, and of course, when they do something like Nintendo Selects now, the eShop version of that goes down too.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
Thing is, you can always sell off your physical copies.
Yeah,
if you can.
You want at some point to change
the digital
version. But
if his concern is being able to roll forward, maybe that's not something that they actively engage in.
Right, but I'm just saying, like, you cannot sell your digital copies.
Yeah, an asymmetric situation. Yeah, that's what I said. The fungibility of physical. Whether, you wanted to just get it for cash or trade-in value, or, like you said, you could say, actually, you know, I would like this on a system all the time, and then, you know, you might have to take something of a hit, but you could, you know, get what you can for it and then buy the digital version as well, especially if it was on sale. You know, that, you've got more options that way round than committing straight. I tend to commit to digital stuff for stuff I have very high level of certainty.
Yeah.
Is really going to benefit from that, and it's something I'm going to enjoy a lot of. Something like Mario Maker, I did that with. Splatoon, I bought physical.
Right. And I've actually been doing the whole converting my physical collection. I'm trying to, you know, make space in my apartment.
Yeah, sure.
On the PlayStation 3 and on Steam, there's a lot of PlayStation 3 games right now that are coming out on Steam, like especially from Sega. And there are some games that I bought physically for PlayStation 3 that I've never actually touched. And then I look up on Amazon, like on the Amazon Marketplace, I could sell them sometimes for more money than they cost on sale on PSN or Steam. So I've been doing that. Like I've been converting in a way my collection, and that's something that you can do when you've got the physical copies.
But so it's nice when that opportunity arises.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did it with Tekken Tag Tournament 2, and that was on sale on the eShop.
Right.
A little bit of arbitrage.
There you go. Alright, so I promised Oops All Emails, and you're going to get it. But there's another thing we haven't done in a while. It's not emails.
Now Playing?
John, you and I haven't done an Now Playing in a while.
We haven't.
And to do an Now Playing, we need to have a break.
Oh, yeah.
So let's have a break. And when we come back, it's time for your listener mail.
I like how Now Playing is now being hyped.
Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview. Mario and Sonic at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games on 3DS by Don Cooten. If any series needs a reboot, it's this one. Make it a grimdark with Mario and Sonic going for one last shot at gold to make their lives meaningful. Mario is overweight, divorced, and hated by his ex-wife and kids, and Sonic's life is destroyed by a gambling addiction. One must defeat the other in Rio in order to put the final nail in the coffin. Bonus, don't drink the water, and oh yeah, minigames! I was actually going to go with Sonic's been caught using PEDs more times than what's-her-name.
Hey, gotta go fast.
Gotta go fast. God, Sonic, you need help. We also have a review. Pokken Tournament on Wii U by Donald Terrio. Donald's review is in progress, but should give you a good overview of this Pokemon fighter. He details all the modes and Pokemon, but holds off on a score pending a playthrough on the online modes. FYI, I think they added a Pokemon in this one. His name is Slideshow. you laugh, but there probably is a Pokemon named that by now.
There probably is. He's probably like some... probably like a camera. And
you know what? That's it. That's it.
An anthropomorphic camera named Slideshow.
This game introduced Slideshow, which will be in the next Pokemon games, Sun and Moon, and we just found out now that his power is the ability to slow down time. Like they very
slow down time online.
They very secretly put him in there. We're going to see him in and Gold and Sun and Moon. So.
Alright, and we have a review. Mutant Mud Super Challenge for Wii U and 3DS by Zach Miller. We get a full review from Zach, and Neil chimes in with a second opinion as well. Their reviews boil down to two simple words. Get good. And we have a preview of Miitomo on mobile by Don Koopman. Finally, the Wii Voting Channel gets a next-gen reboot if you want to answer prying questions to share with your friends and purchase goofy outfits with virtual currency. This is your jam. Looking forward to really getting dark with this one.
It's everybody votes, first off.
Yeah.
And secondly, I miss that channel every day. Dogs or cats? Mm-hmm. Pizza or french fries? Death?
I kind of liked it, man. I'll be honest with you, I kind of liked it. It was fun and stupid.
It was definitely stupid. It was definitely stupid.
Well, maybe I am the target audience for Miitomo. You heard it here first. You know?
John Miitomo Lindemann.
Yes, I like peanut butter more than jelly.
And I want the world to know it.
I'm going to share it on Twitter. There you go.
That's right. You can get this and more me photos of John Lindemann right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back with your listener mail again. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I always say that the second half of the show. It's habit. I'm not even going to try to fight it. But we've got more email. Guillaume.
Owen writes, while most Nintendo fans have an answer to what they think the best game in most Nintendo series is, I have never once heard this discussion for the Punch-Out series. I have played the three console games in the series over the last 2 years, and my opinion is that Super Punch-Out is the strongest in the series. In my opinion, by not using a three-round structure, it has a better sense of momentum over the other two. And as a late SNES game, it is the best-looking and overall feels the most satisfying to play. Clearly, the NES game is the most popular, but I feel this is mostly a result of it being an early release in its console cycle, 1987 versus Super Punch-Out's 1994 release. Anyways, I would love to hear your opinion on the matter and perhaps on the series as a whole.
So, I've actually never given this one much thought. I played all of them.
Punch-Out's incredibly important to me, going back to his sort of point about the sort of point in the cycle, because when we first got an NES, we got it with Punch-Out. You know, that was because the NES didn't get it until 87.
Super Punch-Out's probably the better. I mean, it's the better game, but.
For me, there's different arguments. I mean, I think what I like about Super Punch-Out over the original is probably just that it looks better, looks less weird.
Yeah.
The proportions and all that, the transparency. I like the fact that you get more kind of distinct and complex, essentially enemy patterns. You know, the fighters you're going against, their attack patterns are kind of more interesting, more different, more kind of more intricate. I think the original Punch-Out is a bit more just about obviously you have to learn the patterns. There are little tricks to get it, star punches and stuff, but I think it's a little more leveraged on being very quick, you know, with the reflexes.
Yeah, I think of that game almost as like an early kind of like dance kind of game, or like Rock Band sort of thing, where you had to learn a pattern and just keep doing it over and over and over until you absolutely like knew it completely cold.
Once you're getting into the really difficult fighters, you know, the punishment for getting it wrong is such that it kind of does get like that. I said, Super Punch-Out, I feel like it's always more forgiving, but then it's kind of balanced out by the fact that you get these fighters that have more intricate kind of attack patterns and strategies than their counterparts in the NES game did. Like, you get I think it's fairly late on, you get the sort of old guy with the stick and all that kind of stuff, you're really quite wacky out there stuff, even for Punch-Out, with some really quite complex kind of attack patterns and stuff. And the one round structure is kind of interesting, because the three round in NES, and subsequently in the Wii Punch-Out game, it's got a nice kind of tension to it sometimes, because of course if you knock them down three times in one round, it's a TKO. So there can be a real tension about how can I knock this guy out in time before the he gets saved by the bell, and then we go to the next round, and maybe I won't be able to knock him down three times in that round. So I mean, I guess in some ways that might be irritating. I kind of liked it, the first round, I guess the fact that it was sort of uninterrupted in the Super Nintendo game, might be seen as a plus.
Well, there was an element of strategy to that too, because if you knocked him down right at the end of a round, he was going to come into the next round with a lot more health than if you left him just hanging on.
Yeah, that was the other thing, is that you could leave his health maybe, and then maybe try and sort of say, okay, I'm going to get a sort of cheap knockdown early in the next round, and then it's kind of just about knocking him down twice after that. To get to the
because getting
TKO.
Three is very hard in one.
It can round. Be unless you really kind of work in the star punches and stuff. There's very little kind of strategies about how you can knock people out fast. I guess that's the thing. I mean, with Super Punch Out, instead of the star punches, you've got that special meter that's kind of referenced by Little Mac's character in Smash Brothers. Which you're building up with every blow. In this case, you're building up with every successful kind of punch you land, and it
kind
goes
of like
down.
the arcade game also.
Yeah, I've never had the pleasure of playing the arcade game, but I think the Super Punch Out is definitely sort of much closer.
It is very much closer.
And then, of course, the Wii game, being that it was more of a nostalgia thing for the original Punch Out, which was the popular one. Goes back to NES Punch Out. And I mean, if I was going to pick one, I might pick the Wii game, because I think the biggest thing is that it does have very kind of a lot of, more so the Super Punch Out, more unique sort of fighter patterns. You got all the fighters from the original NES game, and then a few extra ones from Super Punch Out, and one new one and stuff. But they're different this time. They're not just clones. When you get the certain characters where they just change a little something about Popinski and Macho Man. Now they're actually a lot more different, in the Wii game. But also you got title defense, where the fact that you fight them again and they've got some new thing about them that changes up the patterns, makes them harder. King Hippo's got that stupid manhole cover tape to his belly.
Yeah. Title defense is hard.
It's really hard, but it's amazing. It's so good. I absolutely love that. That for me really puts the Wii game over the top. And it has multiplayer, which is not great, but it's a laugh. I played it a little bit. It's not terribly deep,
at least it's there, right? I mean,
it's there, and it is actually fun if you try it. It's not the kind of thing you're ever going to be playing for big long sessions, but to pull out for a bit of a novelty every now and again, it's kind of cool.
I have a confession to make. They never made a Punch Out for Game Boy, so and I did friends with Nintendos, but none of them were really that good at Punch Out. So really, the only Punch Out that I've finished is the Wii one, and by finish I mean finish up to the title defense thing, not
to beating Mr. Sandman the first time.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I don't have a lot of nostalgia for the NES game, I suppose, and the Super Nintendo one. Yeah, it was not even on my radar, right? And I did pick it up on the Wii on the Virtual Console, but then the meter thing seemed like I was confused by it, and then I moved on to some other Virtual Console games.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, the one thing I really like about the Star Punchy kind of thing, and they've really took this to another level in the Wii game, is kind of it's almost sort of puzzle-ish in terms of figuring out how you can earn those, I mean, I guess, again, some people might like the Super Punch Out because it is more transparent. But I don't know, I kind of like the fact that these, it's a boxing game, but you're almost just getting to kind of, traditional kind of boss fight, puzzling out how to beat them kind of thing. And I mean, just the fact that, especially if you're doing time trials in the Wii game, to the point where you're really kind of boiling it down, and just how you can sort of string earning the star punches together and knock these people out way faster than you ever would have thought possible the first time you did it and stuff. I just they've reached a really good sort of level of nuance in the Wii game while still retaining that sort of Twitch arcade gameplay that obviously the series is based on.
Yeah, and not only the boss fights are puzzlish, but also the game teaches you how to beat these bosses the game has missions, right? I can't remember when you unlock them, but maybe you have to finish the game once
It gives you little achievements style things that sort of suggest right. something that you could do against
yeah.
them.
Right.
And those things are really just like, okay, well, the only way that you can actually finish this mission or this achievement is if you figure out, you know, the special trick, you know,
yeah.
like hit him when he's blinking or whatever. Like he, and once you figure that out, it's easier to figure it out, to figure these tricks out in these missions than it is when you're actually playing. Because when you're playing the actual game, then you're going to be tempted to just try to land every punch that you can. Whereas in these mission things,
you're just kind of dodging and punching rather than trying, sort of stepping back from it and then specifically
right.
trying to just meet that.
So without telling you what the weaknesses are, these missions kind of steer you. Like they give you less room to make mistakes. Like they
put you in the right direction.
You,
rather,
yeah. Yeah.
So I will say, personally, I have a lot of nostalgia for the NES game, and I view the Wii game almost as like a hyper-enhanced remake of the NES game. Because in a lot of ways, like, if you know how to beat a lot of the starting fighters, it is remarkable how faithful that game is in a lot of ways.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's very much so. Except, like I said, some of them, they change more because
sure.
they were
yeah,
clones
yeah.
originally. And then you get the title defense versions, which, really, like I said, that's where it elevates itself beyond just being...
It's definitely... very enhanced. I mean, more than just graphics. I mean,
yeah,
there's
but,
a lot
but
more
it's
stuff
got, like,
there.
All new fighters, like Hondo.
Oh,
right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, yes.
Never before seen. Yeah,
yeah, it's
yeah
a completely
yeah.
different guy.
I know. It's not just that it's got more stuff in it. It's just that, like, it very much tries to remake the spirit of that game.
Yes,
like,
definitely.
But I will speak, and I'm not being an asshole and coming up with silly, goofy answer like I normally do here. I do have a lot of affinity for that dumb arm wrestling game that they made.
Which is the guy
yeah,
under the
yeah,
mask. Oh, the DK fight that you get at the very end of Punch Out Wii is also amazing. He is hilarious.
The thing that always gets me kind of excited whenever I have found the arcade machine is just how ridiculous it is.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the ethos of Punch Out and then turns it into this very, very like late 80s let's make a movie about an arm wrestling thing kind of
over
mentality.
The, over the top, you mean?
It's so in there. It's
Goal
so
on Globus, Stallone Opus.
Oh yeah, it's That game goes places. Like there's a moment where you sit down and you're like, oh, this is Piston Honda again. He's got a different name this time, but there he is. I'm gonna arm wrestle him. And it's not a good game, but it had two screens. It had like this weird, like there was a situation where the judge is standing behind you to make sure it's a fair arm wrestle. The whole thing is so asinine. It's kind of amazing. And I was always bummed out because whenever we'd go to PAX, we'd go to the classic arcade room. Mm-hmm. And I always immediately tried to find one because that feels like the kind of thing they would bring to PAX. And I never saw one.
Really?
And yeah, it was never on that in that list. It was always like...
Because I've played it before and I would have thought that would have been where I played
so,
it.
Yeah, I know. I played it in an old arcade at like a mini golf place. Like it's... It just happened to be they had a beat-up old machine of it there. It's a cool, stupid game. It's not nearly as good as any of the Punch-Outs. Like, it's not that polished. But it is kind of dumb fun in its own right. And like, if you're asking me what game I like to play the most, it's probably the Wii game. If you're asking me what game I secretly want to go play right now, it's arm wrestling. And the fact it's just called arm wrestling is such, like,
yeah,
Sega Master
yeah,
System
exactly.
naming conventions here. It's... All it needs is graph paper mm-hmm. for its cover, and we're in there. But instead, it's the ads. So to give you an idea how deep it was in there, the ads for this game had were like newspaper, like old sports page with like pictures, like headshots of the competitors, like it was a sports report. And it was like the headline was like get in on the new wrestling craze, and it was written. It was just idiocy, and it's magnificent.
I don't know, it's not really related, but there is an Iwata asks for Punch-Out, right?
There is.
I'm not sure if it's... Yeah, it's still there. I think they might mention the arm wrestling thing. Like they,
I'm sure they do, because it's almost you almost couldn't.
Hmm.
It's so awesome and stupid, and like I feel like it's the kind of thing that when people at Nintendo talk about it, they just start laughing,
right?
Because you almost have to. It's either unbelievably not self-aware, or 100%. Aware and awesome. Yeah. I don't know, but whatever way, it's cool and funny and stupid. All right. So the next two emails go together. I'll go ahead and read them. So Pseudo Shuff from Austin, Texas writes, "Dear RFN, I hear a lot of moaning from gamers these days about quote backtracking and quote fetch quests and quote padding as the prime evils of game design. My question is, why do these aspects of gaming get criticized so vehemently? I know they don't exactly move the story along, but how many games do we play for the story anyway? Also, can you think of any positive examples of a game where these things actually made the experience more enjoyable? Thanks for hosting such a great podcast." And as a related topic, I linked these two together. Holden writes, "Hello, RFN. My topic concerns the quality of life in game design." Parenthetically, he's not talking about quality of life. "My question is, does the Western games media, as well as Western game developers, focus too much on quality of life in their rhetorics? Moreover, how integral do you think quality of life concerns are in game design, and how does it compare to the other faculties of game development? For a little context, I beat Metroid Zero Mission last week, a game known for being punchy, breezy, and a distillation of what makes Metroid great. In short, it was all these things, and I found it very underwhelming. I have no desire to use my disinterest to bash the game, yet, in comparison to the laboriously confusing, labyrinthian monster known as Metroid Prime 2, a game not known for its gentle handling, I'll go with the latter. I'm well aware that I'm undercutting my own question with my comparison."
James, are you sure you didn't write this?
I didn't. No, because
he would require
it. It just sounds like you're rambling, kind of blah 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 blah. Well, and I understand that I'm completely contradicting myself. And go.
No, I don't think he contradicts himself. I think he's saying. I mean, it's interesting that these two emails came in relatively close together because he's talking about quality of life, and his example is a Metroid game that is notorious for not requiring you to do much in the way of backtracking.
Yeah, this case, I think probably the most way you could kind of boil down these sort of lifestyle concerns is like respect for your time, I guess, would be kind
exactly
of the core thing, you know, respect for the user's time. And, you know,
right.
When you talk about reviewers maybe talking, you know, very kind of negatively about backtracking, fetch quests, padding, that Suda has talked about, that's a lot of why they might do that, is because they feel like it doesn't have, you know, you're talking about game design that doesn't have respect for the user's time. And I suppose that, again, you know, to talk about that, I mean, how much that kind of affects you might be different from how much it affects a reviewer. For a start, reviewers working on a schedule. You know, so,
right.
You know, they have a very clear imperative to get through the thing, see what it's got to offer, and then write their assessment. Whereas, you know, you might not have that, kind of concern. Also, of course, this varies very much by age group. You know, people have a lot more spare time at different times in their life, you know, generally when they're younger, you know, but it might ebb and flow with career stuff and, you know, college, all that. So, you know, I mean, again, some people, you know, might go through periods of their life where, you know, they don't really care whether it has like a lot of respect for your time or not. But then, you know, a year or two later, they might find, yeah, actually, you know, I don't want to have to wade through some of this, crunchy stuff to get to all the kind of meat of the game. So
yeah, I mean, part of it too is I think how mandatory it feels. Like, do you have to, like, to progress in the game in any way, do you have to go and grind a bunch of enemies or do something dumb like that?
Right. The you know, the words used or the criticism, they're all the reviewer is trying to get at a certain quality of the game. like some games really feel like they're wasting your time, right? That, as Greg pointed out,
it feels like
they don't respect. Yeah, I know. As a reviewer, you're going to try to put a name on it or to try to describe it, and yeah, so you're going to be. I don't know where I'm going with this. Sorry.
Well, I think you're going to be willing to label.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, but also like the backtracking, like you might hear complaints about backtracking when a reviewer is reviewing Monster Tale on the DS, where it was obviously kind of a way to artificially lengthen the game. Every item that you got in that game on the map was like diametrically opposed, right? Like you needed to get to point A, and then the next point you had to go to was at the other side of the freaking map. And then you got that item and you had to backtrack all the way to the beginning and get the next item. Like it was very poorly conceived. So,
perhaps in some cases, not necessarily that one, I've not played it, but that it was not so much even poorly conceived, but just deliberately put in there to try and lengthen the game. And that's when people tend to talk about padding, because that's generally what that's used for.
Right, but backtracking in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Like, it can be a positive thing, like, many people enjoy, most people... Anyway, most people on this podcast like
a person enjoys his name is Fred.
Yeah. Anyway, so in Metroid, like it is because you get a power up and you feel empowered, you know. And the section of the map where you had trouble before, all of a sudden you can just jump through the freaking enemies. You destroy them by touching them, and it feels so good, right? So that's one case where like the backtracking is fantastic. Like these areas at the beginning that gave you so much trouble, all of a sudden you can just blast through them and it feels great.
And but... also, I mean, I would say with Zero Mission in particular, that the fact that once you start going back to explore areas of the game, once you've got the fully powered up suit from sort of the epilogue section, you realize that those sections had like elements in the design that that use some of those late game power ups that you were completely oblivious to. And that's really kind of fun to see that they kind of snuck this stuff past you in a way. And they sort of sets your mind alight with, I can go all over the entire map and see all these sort of additional elements to the level design that I missed, you know, when I went through them first time and all that kind of stuff. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, technically, it remains backtracking. You're going back to somewhere you went before, but probably wouldn't be labeled that, in a sort of pejorative way because it's fun. And so usually where people will use padding or backtracking or fetch quests is where they feel like, well, it's not adding any value. It's not adding fun. Mm-hmm. It's just there, presumably to consume time when, my time is valuable. I'd prefer it didn't just consume it in some attempt to like make it harder to trade in at the used games store or else these things are put in for, to make people feel like they got value for money or whatever else.
A bullet point on the back of the case.
All that kind of stuff. But I mean, to go back to what Holden wrote about, sometimes there is a feeling of maybe a feeling of accomplishment, maybe that goes with playing, overcoming something that is kind of not just difficult or not just unforgiving, but I guess there are things about Metroid Prime 2 that just could have been done better. I think they're made more explicit, or it's kind of similar to like some of the things they did to the Water Temple in Ocarina of Time when they remade it for the 3DS. Just make it a few things more transparent and some frictions like unequipping the boots and all that kind of stuff. I don't mind the design having some layers to it that are, that require effort to overcome, whether that be sort of twitch reflexes or with your brain or whatever else. You don't want it to be too much just like, well, it's just kind of irritating to go through. So, it can be a fine line sometimes when people perceive where is that kind of deliberately sort of convoluted design and where is it just inartful.
Well, I mean, for me, it's also in the UI. I mean, like, sometimes, I mean, yeah. A game can waste your time, like, forcing you to jump through a bunch of hoops to manage your inventory or having to dig through a bunch of menus, you know, not having stuff that you can kind of, like, hotkey to, like, maybe, you know, a particular mm-hmm. direction on it, like your gamepad or something
that
like
that.
That
speaks more to the quality of life.
Yeah, but yeah. It also speaks, like, it depends if the designers had a good idea, managed to make those elements fun. Like, managing mm-hmm. an inventory can be fun, like, in some yeah. Resident Evil games. Well, not so much, but maybe, like, in...
well, they tried to make a sort Zombie of a... They made a game out of it in Resident Evil 4, didn't they? Like,
right,
whole,
yeah.
Like, fitting it together in the suitcase or the
yeah, or in Zombie U, like, you've got the whole, like, at any time someone could be attacking you, a zombie could be attacking you while you're rummaging through your stuff, right?
Yep.
But whereas when something like a badly designed RPG or something that's just really old, like you're
Resident
in Dragon
Zero.
Quest,
let's go with that
or
one.
Like each of your characters in your party has places for 8 items, and then you have to move items from one character's inventory to the next character.
Yeah,
just
Earthbound has that problem, doesn't it?
Yeah,
right.
So,
and it's just aggravating.
Yeah, so yeah, RE0, they each character has inventory. Billy and Rebecca have their own inventory, but also they got rid of the inventory crates that are part of the Resident Evil franchise, so you just have to drop shit on the floor and go back and get it later. Like,
yeah, stuff like that's terrible.
That's awful, and that's backtracking just to go get shit you dropped on the floor because they got rid of the inventory crates in the Resident Evil series.
That's
the kind of thing you only
find
out over time, too.
Was that supposed to be something about the two characters? Like, you
yeah,
know,
I think they figured, well, you've got two, that's enough, right? No, it's not enough.
So odd. But in terms of whether this stuff is over, you know, I think, look, there's been a natural growth in concern over this stuff about respect for your time and all that, because the age of gamers is going up. And
games are getting longer. Than they've ever been.
But and also, you know, just apart from the fact that, you know, people are getting older, they've got jobs, they've got all this other stuff. Think about, you know, just the kind of explosion in media in general, social media, TV. You know, there's just more and more kind of plentiful content that has a, you know, claim to make on your time. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
we talked about it in the first segment.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's only natural that those concerns, you know, as they've sort of, you know, become greater within the general gaming populace, have filtered into reviews. Of course, that's only natural. However, you know, if you're a one person, you know, you have your own set of circumstances and you have your own preferences about your game. So again, it comes back to what we said about the Fire Emblem thing for me, in terms of if the reviewer has articulated fully, you know, sort of some of these concerns, rather than just sort of saying, oh, well, it does this, therefore it's bad, then you can take that and apply it to your circumstances, and that's okay. So I don't think it's a bad thing to just like, oh, well, this person's pushed for time because he's a reviewer or because he's 40 or, you know, like, but I'm not, so I don't want to hear about that shit. You know, like, I feel like if they've really gone into it, the proper, you know, sort of breakdown of it, a proper analysis and how they've communicated that, you could disentangle those factors and apply them to yourselves. And again, there'll be other reviews that are probably less preoccupied with that kind of stuff, because there are people that still love playing, you know, a game for a hell of a lot of time. There's still a lot of that going on, as long as it's gone away.
I'm surprised at the amount of stuff like this that we do see, because, I mean, people, like, in the testing of these games before they get to market, people play these games for a hell of a long time.
Yeah,
like,
and
you're
sure a tester, lot of
you
these
play
comments...
these games for hundreds of hours, so obviously
you think you'd be more acutely aware of that than the end user could ever be.
But I think, like, testers play even the short games, like, over and over again, to the point where they get sick of them and can't see the look at them anymore.
Too
right?
Close. So playability testing is part of the testing job. It's a question of how much does the company who has hired them to do the testing care about the playability stuff, and how much of it is and not care is the wrong word. When they do the cost benefit analysis of, all right, they want us to hew this down, is it worth it?
Yeah,
and it depends on how the company does their playability testing, and it's you know, it's very company to company. I would say that, you know, using the example from Holden's email, you know, I am the person that he probably calls out the undercutting my own question when he mentions Prime 2. But speaking to it, generally speaking, the mechanics of the Prime games don't appeal to me, but I don't dislike them. Like, I enjoyed 3, which is more hewed down, which is probably the game he would least enjoy of the series.
Yeah, well, but, yeah, that, you know, if he likes the feeling of overcoming the labyrinth, like, you would like 3 the least, because it's the most straightforward. Right. It's more shootery, it's more segmented, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, probably
The puzzles are usually very localized to where you get the item. And then the puzzle, the item's role in the puzzles progress from there. It's more Zelda-y that way.
Like I said, navigation wasn't as confusing because it didn't have the light world, dark world thing where you could go to one place through the other dimension and all that kind of stuff. So you know, that introduces a level of sort of opacity to like just looking on the map and can you get there from where you are?
Right.
That always is, like I said, you know, always going to be sort of tricky. But I guess that can be part of its appeal. The feeling of mastering that can be part of its appeal.
Sure.
So I hear what Holden says from the point of view that like, it would be a shame in a way if these concerns were to the point that it kind of drove that kind of game design out of business or something. Because that would be a particular kind of satisfaction for some people that have the time and the dedication to devote to it, you know, that they would lose. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of this stuff is not just like design, you know, choices or the kind of experience you're trying to craft. It's just stuff that isn't streamlined. It isn't you know, optimized as well as it could be a lot of the time. So
right.
You see that with all the Zelda remakes. They've been making these kinds of changes, you know, with the touchscreen interface, making how he calls up the ladder faster and all that. You know, they've had all these years to say, yeah, there's a lot of things here that, you know, people were tolerated because these were big, huge releases at the time, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And now people are going to go, if they're going to go back and play them, you know, we need to show some concern for these quality of life issues.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would say that, using the specific example there, the quality of life issue for me isn't the portal jumping. It's that in one side of the map, you can't really explore as freely because you're taking damage. And it's always seemed to me part of anti-ethos to what the game is. Like
it's an exploration-based game. I mean, look, it's not as if it's... there's a little strain of it in other Metro games where an area is really hot or whatever, but that normally tells you not to bother. You know, like, you know,
right.
You know, like, okay, this isn't really for you yet. Go elsewhere. Whereas the dark world,
right,
clearly you have to go through it. You know, that's...
Yeah, it's a big portion of the game. It's like, well, I don't really want to explore here. I don't want to be here. I want to be somewhere else. So that part always felt kind of like, okay, is this what they're going for? Or is this kind of an incongruous thing? That one always felt like... Maybe that was a decision that they might like to have back.
I think
the whole concept of recharging your health and like these
things
was just a waste of the player's time.
Well, just make it faster, at least. You know, yeah. Like I mean, I know you could do that, but if you're late in the game, if you've got the light beam or whatever, you shoot the crystal and then its aura recharges health faster. But just in general, like, well, you know, if somebody's going to bother to say, okay, I've reached safety, now I'm going to recharge the health. Well, you know, why make them sit there for that many seconds? I mean, are we really saying that there's some sort of trade-off there where they're going to say, actually, no, I can't be bothered to sit here. I'm just going to go out there and die. You know? Like,
yeah.
No, it just, you know.
I'm so sick of the dark world.
If you
just
think,
take me.
If you think that through, you know, I think like that's something that, in some cases, like I said, it's not just the kind of experience they were going for. It's just something that, you know, I know it's a lack of perspective or whatever, but they just didn't quite get right.
Pseudo Shuff's email, when he talks about a situation where backtracking really changes the, you know, makes the experience better for me. And we've talked about this game way too much, and Guillaume's going to disagree heavily. Xenoblade Chronicle X with the scale. Like, that's such a different thing all of a sudden. Like, the whole scale of the world changes. You're still backtracking. You're still going back to Primordia to look around. But suddenly, Primordia is a very different place, even though you're the one that changed, not it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right.
No, I
don't disagree.
Okay. All right. I was just curious to be like, no, fuck this game. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
No. But if you had talked about the fetch quests, I would have...
No, the fetch quests are what they are. Yeah. I mean, but here's the thing. I will give that game credit. Half of the types of fetch quests, the ones where you get them for killing things, it just gives you a way to bypass them altogether. It's like you can just go get these things from a computer somewhere. The problem are the ones where they're pickups, not drops. And those are the ones where you're like, all right, I need to go... I'm just going to look up where these things are. Because because the game will tell you they're in oblivion.
Great. I just want to make a point about the padding and the like in RPGs, because I talked a lot about how I couldn't get really into Breath of Fire and stuff like that. But the thing is, Sudoshev says that the backtracking, fetch quests, padding are held up as evils in game design, but it's really all about the execution, really. There's not really that much of a difference between, as a whole, between a Dragon Quest game and Breath of Fire. Right, and yet you'll see the reviewers be much more inclined to give Dragon Quest, high scores and to praise it, and whereas I went back to Breath of Fire and it was just a little bit too grindy for me, and Dragon Quest can be grindy, but the difference is that in Dragon Quest, you feel like you can make progress and. It becomes a decision of when you need to turn back,
exactly.
to recharge at the inn or something like that.
Well, it's just like last week when I talked about the trainer tunnels where you have to
those are very Dragon Questy.
Yeah, right. But it didn't really bother me because you can kind of avoid the trainers if you want. Like there's a little bit of an option there.
Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, so you've got the gameplay. It is a decision that you can make as the player. Okay, do I avoid them? Do I, do I try to grind? Do I try to force my way through? But so, and good games will give you those options. Whereas Breath of Fire, I literally had a spot where I tried. There was a spring where you could recharge your health. And then the path to go on in the cave. And I recharged my health. I would make a few steps towards stairs to progress. I would run into a battle against low level enemies and I would come out of that battle with almost no health points. And the enemies would give me no herbs, no healing items. The fights really don't give you enough money to go stock up on healing items. So the only choice is to walk back to the spring and then try again. And then you get in another fucking random encounter. And
yeah, welcome to that game.
Yeah, and I had to go up seven levels before I could make it up the stairs. And
Skies of Arcadia on the Dreamcast is that way.
Right.
And it's fucking insufferable.
Right, so there's grindy in Dragon Quest, and there's grindy in Breath of Fire, where in one game you feel okay, it's an adventure, I'm going to venture out as far as I can, and then I try to keep some health, keep some of my strength, come back and heal up and restock and everything. And then you've got another game where clearly it's just wasting your time. If you can't make it up the first step in the game until you've done battle after battle and leveled up seven levels, it's just bad design.
You have to sit there and just do the same thing until you reach whatever arbitrary goal they set.
Well, and that's the old Bravely Default 1, where you basically turn the game to autoplay, you turn the speed on high, and you just run back, turn the difficulty down to easy, and just run back and forth in place until you're level whatever you need to get to.
Yeah,
it's
dumb.
They made it super easy, but it's also incredibly stupid and ridiculous. It's more amusing, actually.
But why would you want to do that?
Well, because it got you through levels. It got you through, this boss is, seven levels stronger than they probably should be.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the big problem, with Bravely Default is just the fact that you feel like you're just running in circles for that second
The
half.
End game.
That really does just... I said some of this stuff is psychological as well, as well as just, I think the quality of the execution is absolutely central to it in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So it's something fundamentally, might be pretty similar, but you wouldn't attach the pejoratives like backtracking and fetch quests if it's executed well and is therefore fun. But also the psychological elements that they can be, I think stuff like Skyward Sword as well, some of those tasks that you're doing And you can talk about the fact that, you know, getting your weapons back for after the volcano goes off, you know, isn't that fun or how fun it is or whatever. But I think psychologically you are a lot less open to it because you're just circling around the same places over and over again. You know, so that's kind of, there's the quality of the task itself, and then there's that psychological backtracking feel as well. And that definitely kicked in with the back half of Bravely Default, because you just, you know, you're going through.
Because you are experiencing the stuff.
The same thing again and all that kind of stuff. So, like I said, Bravely Second, while it's, you know, uses a lot of stuff for the first game, I just feel like the way it spread out and paced and stuff, I never felt like I quite reached a point in the back half of that game where it got that iffy. You know, the hours, especially because it has got loads of quality of life type conveniences with the speeding up the animations, manipulating the encounter array, using favorites to, you know, sort of save job loadouts for different situations and auto battle command sets and all this kind of stuff. You know, it just, even though you put loads of hours into it, it goes by really fast. You know, like it feels, especially being portable. You know, it does go by a lot quicker. Well, I guess Bravely Default went by quick enough until the second half. And like I said, I mean,
I cleared the first half in about a week and a half.
I've ended up clearing Bravely Second in a matter of weeks instead of months, you know, even though, like, gameplay-wise, it's a game time-wise, it's pretty similar. So, I mean, I think, you know, like I said, there's a lot of different factors here. You've got quality, you've got psychological factors, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, these concerns, especially with the whole rise of mobile gaming and all that, where, you know, and the fact that dedicated gaming is being threatened with being crowded out altogether and all that. These concerns are not going away. You know, the developers are only going to get more and more kind of cognizant of this kind of stuff because they know, you know, back to Nintendo's old, you know, line from years ago with the Wii and DS, we're competing with everything, you know? And so, you know, when you compete with everything, you do have to respect people's time.
Unless you're making Project Cross Zone. Then fuck your time.
I mean, the fact that you own the game proves that your time doesn't matter to you.
No, the fact that I own Project Cross Zone 2 proves my time doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
Fuck me. Why? Why did I buy that? All right, moving on. Let's move on.
John writes, hey guys, and also James.
First off, I really appreciate when the emails start out with, hey guys, and then some other slam on one person.
I like to see it already.
Hey, gentlemen, and John was one of my favorites.
It's kind of a random example, James. But anyways, this past week, my girlfriend egged me on to buy a 3DS because I could play it in bed next to her without being in the living room playing my Wii U. I love playing Splatoon, and it is by far the most captivating game I have played on a Nintendo system since Conker's Bad Fur Day. My question is, what 3DS games out there?
It's got a good multiplayer, John. I don't know. Yeah.
It did. You know, the D-Day inspired thing is actually really good.
Yeah, I like it.
My question is, what 3DS games out there offer an experience something like Splatoon? Or, in another way, what 3DS titles offer the best multiplayer online enjoyment? Enjoying my 3DS so far, and hope you can help me add a few games to my library.
The Reservoir Dogs thing, not so much. That's not quite so good. But and John, it's not a random example. It was from an email a couple weeks ago.
That's true.
So... What's interesting is that 3DS does support online play, but there's not a ton of games that have it.
Well, I guess, really? I mean, you know, you've got the stuff that's kind of Monster Hunter and...
Right, that's your Monster, two Monster Hunters.
And it's some of the games that it's kind of influenced.
Yeah.
But again, not necessarily the same as Splatoon. Oh, of course, you've got games which have got the sort of obvious analogs on Wii U, Mario Kart 7 and Smash are both pretty good online. I've used that, but would you need those when he's already got a Wii U? Right? So, I mean, you're talking more about the dedicated stuff here.
Yeah. I mean,
it's all about Federation Force, isn't it? This is what it's here for.
Yes. Do I got a game for you?
It is. Shut up, John. It is filling a niche that isn't really being actively filled on that system. Like, I understand. When I was researching for this question, I went, oh, that's why Federation Force exists.
Yeah. It's, I just, yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's why that's that game why exists. It exists, all right. It's just not there. Like, it's a weird hole in the lineup. I had to add that phrase because John would start giggling if I didn't.
Wish it would have been a Splatoon branded game, but hey.
Well, so James, yeah. I think James has spoken before about it's probably not the easiest to get that.
No. You know,
the fluid dynamics and some of the things on that. I'm sure that's something they'd love to do with NX, you know, get it on a portable where. So it's done so well in Japan, but the chance to get it, get people playing the way they play Monster Hunter with, like, locally with portables and stuff, it could blow up even bigger. So, I mean, that's for the future. But for now, like I said, yeah, I mean, they haven't. Like I said, a lot of the stuff on 3DS that uses online has, you know, has had kind of been replicated on Wii U, hasn't it?
That's the if it's really just a matter of having a game to play in bed, and you're okay having it being a replicated experience, then Smash is probably fine. You know, Smash on 3DS is a good game.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so is Street Fighter 2, right?
Yeah, the launch game. I mean, I don't know.
The challenge is anybody going to be playing it? The Tekken 3D is good. Tetris Axis has online play. It's pretty good, but is somebody going to be out there to play with you is the question.
Yeah. I don't know what the online community for Luigi's Mansion is, but right now, but it's actually pretty good. Yeah, it's a pretty good multiplayer game. You can up to four players, like you're racing to get coins, I think, or golden, I don't know. Like you're hunting specific ghosts, I think. And it's a fun time. It's been a while since I played it. I don't know if they patched it. It was a little bit buggy back when it came out. And one issue it had is that you need to look at the map on the bottom screen, and it's color coded, so colorblind people might not be able to play. Mm. Like, might have difficulties.
It's funny. We spoke about this before in Next Level Games. This seems to be something that they are pushing on the system when, you know, Nintendo themselves not so much.
Mm. Triforce Heroes. Ah.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a lot of fun. I spoke about it. I mean, if you're playing in bed, I think we can safely assume that getting, like, on Skype and all that kind of stuff is out. You're gonna have to deal with the sort of communicating by emoticon and all that kind of stuff. It's fun. It can take a bit to get it to work. I don't know how different it is now because I haven't played it a while. You know, I played it when it was brand new in terms of getting the match in and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's probably evolved a bit since then. But, I mean, there's no denying to me that when it clicks, it's great. It may not click for quite a number of reasons. You know, it might be that, you know, the people you're with just don't quite mesh. You don't quite get that ability to communicate just by, you know, putting the pom-poms or whatever, the item button or the totem button or whatever. So sometimes it works and you're like, oh wow, this is surprising, and then other times it just you're not on the same wavelength. What can I say?
I'm trying to think what else has it that's a lot of fun. I mean, that there was that Resident Evil the Mercenaries,
and Revelations had an online mode, didn't it?
Yeah, 'cause it did, didn't it? Yeah. And I think you can actually get Mercenaries 3D for pretty cheap on the eShop now.
That's frequently on sale.
I would say grab it when it goes on sale because people will have bought it and will hopped on.
Well, the thing about Mercenaries is that it's a high school game. You know, it's so a lot of people kind of ragged on it when it came out, close to the launch or whatever it was, because it's like, oh, this is they're selling a high school game for full price and all that,
one of the first $40 3DS games.
But the point is, you know, now it regularly goes for the kind of price that's more fitting with people's expectations for that kind of experience.
Right.
So even though it's not the sexiest new thing or whatever, you might get some enjoyment out of it on that base. I haven't been tempted, but I could see how it could work.
Guillaume, how do you feel about Explorers?
I would much sooner recommend Kid Icarus. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Like, if you want this, kind of deathmatchy, gameplay. It's a lot of fun, but I lost my copy long ago, and I don't know again what the community is like. So
yeah,
no, I never quite sort of got into that online, even though I enjoyed the single player game a lot. But with multiplayer online games, the most use I tend to get is playing quite casually. I'm not the kind of person who's going, I'm going to play a multiplayer online game for 90 minutes. You know, it is a lot more like, I'm going to dip in, I'm going to have a few matches. Maybe if things are going well, I'll stick around longer, but it's going to be quick. And the thing is, the way, because of Kid Icarus's control scheme and stuff, it always felt like I needed to kind of make an effort to play that game, you know.
Yes.
So get sat in a good position, you know, get myself ready. I don't play too long because then my hands are going to be kind of buggered up. But, you know, at the same time, I wasn't just going to play for a few minutes. And that's why it never really quite caught on with me. The multiplayer. Again, if that had been in the digital phase, that might have been something that got on a bit quicker. But
that might be one to wait for a sale to pop up and say, okay, maybe people will buy it and go online now.
Yeah, it's been like it's been in various eShop sales, and I think it's been given away sometimes. You know, like Club Nintendo stuff.
I think in the final throws of the Club Nintendo.
Yeah, but I think it's a good analog for Splatoon, just because like you've got a variety of weapons, and it's just the matches are short, so it's just like one match after the next, and
it's a bit goofy in the same way.
Yeah,
I don't think it lands as well, but it's trying.
Yeah, well, a few games I think land as well as Splatoon do. Does,
yeah,
but,
Let me be more polite. Yeah. I think it lands really poorly. But
fine.
Yeah.
Let me put a finer point on this, Guillaume. I think the characters are obnoxious.
I don't know how relevant that is in the multiplayer.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember correctly, I think Ironfall has an online mode.
Is Ironfall back on the eShop, or is it still being held in quarantine after it let everybody in to root the system?
It was put back up there.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and of course, there's Sub Wars, which is free to play.
Yep.
But I think that's pretty much a fairly exhaustive list. If you've got people that you can plan to play with, I mean, there's always stuff like Pokemon and things you can try out. But if you just want to hop online and play with randos, then yeah, I think we've probably run through the list pretty well. All right, that's gonna do it for the Oops All Emails cast. You can send your emails, because we still need them, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And wrapping up the show this week, we're gonna go out on actually Owen's suggested theme for the end of the show. So if you want to send your music suggestions, you could send them to the inbox. This is Telltale Heights from Link's Awakening.
Good choice. We missed the 30th anniversary of Zelda got totally overshadowed by the Pokepalooza. But
that did happen a few
weeks ago, the release of the original Legend of Zelda in Japan. This is a bit different, 8-bit Zelda music, but still great.
Yep, this game has really, I mean, considering it's one of the first Zelda games to really centrally theme music as part of its elements.
The narrative features, and everything, yeah.
It features music quite heavily. And, of course, Zelda got its time in the sun on the 25th anniversary, so I can understand Nintendo saying, this is the Pokemon time.
Sure.
But on that, get you some Telltale Heights. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
John, Greg, James, I want to thank you. James. I'm fucking tired. John,
I'd
Greg,
like
Guillaume.
To,
I would like to thank
myself.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm reading the article from last week, and I just read the names. Okay, I'm
James,
sorry.
James, I would like to thank you for staying awake for this entire podcast. James, thank you very
you.
Much.
Above all, I'd like to thank the person without whom this would not be possible.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
To be fair, if I hadn't caught myself, I was going to read Guillaume's name next,
too,
so it would be fine.
The real reason why James said arm wrestling was his favorite podcast game is because he's never beaten Mr. Sandman, clearly.
Shut up, assholes. I look forward to each and every one of you suffering debilitating illnesses so I can make fun of you about it.
You missed your chance when I threw up during recording like 6 years ago.
I don't know. You still have to listen to John every week. One day that'll trigger the same response.
Yeah, one day.
And John, I mean, I'm really just waiting for like dementia to kick in. So,
hey, see, now you're just lashing out.